Hey everyone, welcome back to How to Build an App. We created this podcast to help you refine your idea, build an app that your customers love, get it out into the world, and scale it up.
We pay for the production of this podcast from our full-service app development agency, Strides Development. And we have a few things that you need to know about. First, we have a ton of free resources available for you at howtobuildanapppodcast.com.
Head over there right now, put in your name and email, and we'll send you 7 days of emails with our very best steps for getting started on your app idea. You'll also get our Before You Build ebook and links to our most popular episodes.
Second, if you know you're ready to get started on your app right now and you need some advice, we're offering a free strategy call. We'll help you think through your concept, your launch strategy, your MVP, or whatever you're stuck on.
You can get your free call at howtobuildanapppodcast.com. Hey everyone, welcome back to How to Build an App. I'm your host, Austin Betzer, and I'm here with Beaudry Price. When it comes to building a business, obviously technology is a big part, but is it really the most important?
Lots of the time, founders think that technology is the most important part because it's the part they're not so familiar with. Today, Sai Krishna, the founder of Skapik, talks to us about the journey of not limiting himself with what technology lacks, but overcoming it by being innovative and creative. Awesome. Well, Sai, really excited to have you on the show today. Thank you for coming. So we have Sai Krishna with us today. He's going to tell us a little bit about his story. So Sai, I want to just take just a few minutes and kind of tell us kind of what's your technical background?
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm sort of your textbook definition of an accidental entrepreneur. My journey into the world of building ventures began with a journey of appreciating tech for what it is. I just like building things. I was an undergrad student. I stumbled across side hustles, moonlighting on things that I was passionate about. Before I knew it, I was running as fast as possible in the direction of org or venture building. It's been a fun ride, nearly close to a decade right now, and always been fascinated by how do you build a company that's technology first, but not limited to technology users. And that's mostly where I spent my time.
Are you a developer yourself? Do you have like a development background? I noticed you went to Stanford, is that right? And you got an undergrad and then you got a business. Tell us a little bit about like the technical side of it, just so our listeners kind of understand what you do.
Right. My journey started as a developer, where I was an engineering undergrad. So most of my time went into trying to build hacky new things out there. Built my first startup in the education space back then, because we sort of noticed a part that we could contribute to from a development perspective. That had an exit, took my learnings from there, thought lightning can strike twice, and then tried to build another firm in the AI space right after. Then went on to graduate from Stanford, and the intention behind that was, how do you now combine technical knowledge with business knowledge, where building a company is very different from being technically sound. So these two are important, but it's not like without technical knowledge, you can't build an org or vice versa. So that's really where Stanford was incredibly helpful at just being part of a diverse cohort where tech is one part of multiple things that go into building a company per se. So came out of it a lot more aware. And since then, it's been a combination of org building and tech and product and design, if those were to blend together.
I love that you say, you know, like the technical background is such a tiny piece of like starting or getting started, mainly because as I talk to people and we get through more calls, I'm always trying to convince people that having like your product and having an app built is a tiny, tiny step forward in all the things that you're going to have to do. And so I find that like super interesting as we talk to like more and more founders, because typically the story goes, hey, you know, I got this company and now I'm like, oh crap, I've got to figure out how to market this. I've got to figure out how to bring users in. And that's something that people just need to start thinking about earlier. And I think that's something as a technical founder, that's something that often gets put on the back burner, especially for us, because we're just hands on keyboard, you know, writing the code, getting the product out, not really thinking about do people like the product or how am I going to get people into it. So I think that's super interesting. Did you run into any challenges like that when you started Skapik?
I would think that technical founders tend to over-index on how important technology is to get the startup running, while non-technical founders tend to over-index on technology being the only thing that is preventing them from scaling their ventures up. So on both sides, we have a little bit of a bias. The grass is always greener on the other front, but it is important to understand, like you said, the number of variables that go into making a startup successful or not. And technology is an important part, but definitely not the only part, right? So as a founder who probably knows their world in technology, I think the biggest assumption we tend to make is you build it and they will come, right? If I throw this SaaS product out there, I'm just going to have users magically spring up around it. Very rarely the case, right? As a non-technical founder, I think you tend to over-index on, okay, I've got an idea. Everything is sorted except for the technology. Very rarely is that the case again as well, right? So I think startups are journeys of discovery, both discovering your users as well as your own product while you're sort of searching for product market fit. And the sooner you're able to realize it's a song and dance, and technology is an important but not the only part, I think the better the song and dance can be.
Well, and I feel like that's what a lot of non-technical founders stress the most, because that's the part they're most unfamiliar with, is the technology side of things. And I thought you said a great thing. A lot of founders have this mindset of like, hey, if you build it, they're going to come. Right. And that's not the truth. Rarely is that the truth, at least. And so I'm kind of curious on, you were a founder on a couple different kind of early startups, which you had said, and education that was called Arium. Is that correct? Was it Arium?
That's correct. Yes.
Perfect. And then you had an exit with Arium.
Right.
So tell us a little bit, what is Scapic and what do you guys specialize in? I think it's pretty interesting.
So just as I was getting out of business school, I started noticing that computing evolves in predictable cycles, right? Every 10 to 15 years, the way we've interacted with devices has changed. We've gone from mainframes to desktops, desktops to laptops, laptops to smartphones. The default mode of interacting with these devices has sort of evolved, and there's no reason to believe that we're going to stop with smartphones. So there's a punt that both FAANG companies as well as companies like Scapic took, which is wearable computing, or spatial computing as we call it, as which is virtual and augmented reality headsets, are going to make conferences like these also a little more interesting, where the metaverse sort of was a word that was not spoken about as much, but we were all trying to get towards that space. Now, it makes for a puff piece editorial and the TechCrunch, but how do you really build a world like this? You require software that makes it really easy for brands, businesses, and enterprises to create these virtual and augmented reality experiences in the first place. Because everyone liked talking about VR and AR, but the moment you really got down to business and you saw the number of developers that are required in order to actually execute a project that's half good, there was either sticker shock or just lethargy. Now, we then got into building a no-code platform, like the Webflows of the world, where you'd be able to jump right in. And as a brand or a business, be able to stitch together your own virtual and augmented reality experience and put that out there for your customers, completely based on the browser. Now, that meant that people who wanted to build such experiences, which is marketers, salespeople, as well as designers, now finally had the technical ability to build it as well with a drag and drop tool that really got the job done for them.
Well, and I think that's interesting because, just like you said, people, especially I feel like in those areas, marketing, sales, really anybody without a technical background, undervalue or think that it's super easy to build, you know, an AR like environment and to place like objects like in it. And even with all of the tools and stuff that Apple has given, you know, their Apple developers around machine learning, AR, like all of that stuff, it's still pretty complex to get even a simple environment set up, to put, you know, an environment in a 3D plane. Like, even with all of the stuff that Apple gives you out of the box, that's not necessarily a super easy task to accomplish. And so I think it's super interesting what you guys are doing, because I can already see like the value from like a marketing perspective of being able to interact with basically something you want to buy. That's a super powerful thing. Like, even on Amazon, we do that. Like, when we go to buy furniture and do different things. So I think that's super cool. But I'm really curious, what were you doing when you first visualized and thought of this idea? Were you just, you know, hanging out with some friends? Were you just, I don't know, developing something and were like, man, this would be super cool? Like, what were you doing when this idea just like sparked and came to life?
It was a little bit of pattern matching, which is you just hang around with people who you do believe can teach you a lot. And they sort of have very specific skills and traits that you believe software can be a meaningful part of their lives. So think of somebody in the marketing stack, think of someone who's building a D2C brand, a fellow entrepreneur. So as you sort of interact with these people, and you then begin to notice over a period of time that there are some themes that begin to bubble up again and again and again. One such would be, hey, what is the tool you use for productivity, right? Like, we all tend to exchange whether we're working on Notion, we're working on Trello, we're working on Jira. So I think conversations are built around a few themes. One such theme is about what's your brand doing or what's your company doing out there on the frontiers, right? Something that's like absolutely new. And it's easy water cooler talk, but it's also really useful to build these pattern matching moments around. And we noticed back then when we were getting started, 2018, that a lot of these conversation moments were around, hey, how do I make things in 3D? How do I make things in virtual reality, in augmented reality? Now everybody stopped at talking, right? So there was a very clear pause from having the aspiration to do it versus having the ability to do it. And we've seen this happen in the web a number of times, right? I've wanted to build a website. I have the aspiration to do it, but I don't have the ability to do it. So here comes WordPress, Squarespace, Wix. Or if I want to make great design, again, the aspirations to put something out there in social media that's respectable, well, the ability of being a Photoshop expert is not there. Boom, you have Canva, right? So we started noticing that there is the ability to aspiration gap and the fact that software has always moved towards filling gaps like these. And we saw a world in VR and AR where one such gap could be just as useful or just as important as the industry continues to evolve. So that's really where we started noticing that there is a SaaS play like Scaping that can come into.
So basically, yeah, you were with some mentors, you really like saw a common theme of problems and you're like, I can solve this problem. Is that basically kind of how that happened?
Right. There is a bit of callous optimism, which is the fact that you can be building something out there, which is truly unique and that nobody else has gone about doing it. I do think that that sense of audacity is needed in order to build anything in the first place. But even outside that, there was a sense of, right? Even outside that, I think there was a sense of calibration, which is, if you've noticed across 30 odd conversations that this is starting to repeat out, let's push these conversations out to a point where people can go from expressing desire to expressing intent to open their wallets up. So I think while light bulb movements are great, some of the best planned startups out there in the SaaS space have probably gone from just calibrating with their users on a very, very deliberate sense on what might make sense for them, what might not make sense for them. So we took about 6 months doing that, just trying to understand what parts of the stack that might be useful. And we then cut down every one of our features into just focusing on one vertical, which was e-commerce, and just saying, hey, if you want to build a product, market a product, or sell a product, here's your tool of choice to do it in the 3D VR and AR space.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it really does. And it's kind of interesting because I kind of want to connect this light bulb moment that you talked about to actually making it a real business. Right? Because a lot of our listeners right now probably have this light bulb be like, hey, I see there's a gap in the market, or I have a really good idea and I think it's a really good idea. What steps do you take from, hey, this is a good idea, to this is a business? Did you go like legal? Did you go validate the idea? Did you talk to friends? Like, what was that journey from this is a good idea to we're actually building a business?
I think the first thing to get out of the way is how absolutely useless an idea is unless you do something with it. So the idea in itself is worth 5 cents.
I love that. I love that so much because we get pitched so many things all the time. And 9 out of 10 times, the person pitching us probably doesn't have the skills or knowledge base yet. They can get it, but the skills or knowledge base yet to actually execute on that idea.
Very true. I've got this really cool idea. I just need you guys to build it out now and we can all share the upside. Yes. That's probably the most common version you might be pitched.
Time and time again. And it's funny because multiple times we've had the same idea pitched to us, exact same idea, but nobody has been, I don't know, strong enough or like willing enough to actually execute the idea.
An idea is worth 5 cents unless you do something with it. So you're never going to make anything out of the idea in itself till you decide to get out of bed and do something about it. And the second part is, what do you do with the idea? I think there is a breed of founders who tend to get stuck in what I call as analysis paralysis, which is, hey, I want to set up the company first. I want to set up legal. I want to consult people in order to see whether I have my paperwork in order. Again, your idea is worth nothing, right? Building a company around this from a legal perspective is worth nothing as well. I think there are easier ways to get started. And I would believe that validating your idea, even before validating anything else around the idea, which is the org, is the only thing that the entrepreneur should be focusing on. Building momentum with your customers is way more useful than building momentum on any other parts of the stack just as you're getting started. An easy way to do that is the web. I think the web has been a great equalizer for someone sitting out of Bangalore, India, to connect with someone completely on the other side of the globe and present a product, a service, and or an idea in this case, and actually resonate with them. Now, the levers to do this could be a wait list, could be paying me to do something, could be trying to understand where my pain points are by just hopping on a call. There are numerous very useful ways in order to validate whether you're on the right track or not, because ideas are fragile and ideas are incredibly poorly formed when you first have them. So the chances of you building a successful company around your first iteration of the idea is rare. But the chances of you iterating rapidly in order to get to a point where your customers resonate with what you're building dramatically improves whether what you're building is a hobby or whether you're building is a venture scale product.
It all depends on whether you're a entrepreneur or an entrepreneur, right? Like, that's really what it comes down to.
So you're saying the very first thing you need to do is validate your idea. And I think there's a number of ways to do that. You say to use the web. Some other people decide to, you know, just strictly get data, just running like marketing campaigns, different things like that. When did you actually decide and get the affirmation you needed to actually go in and start developing a product? Did you do that at the very beginning? Did you kind of wait till you had more data and more validation? When did you actually start to develop something?
That's an interesting one. I think we spent a lot of time trying to ensure that we are on the right track. Right? So we used to call it sharpen the axe. There's no time that you spend sharpening the axe that's wasted. Right? You're going to inevitably try chopping a log of wood, which is the product that you're trying to build up. The way that we went about it was we went after customers and we showed them what we call as a hollow prototype. A hollow prototype was just our way of saying, look, we've got the design chops and the talent to build out a product and masquerade as if it exists, while not a single line of code needs to be written just yet. So you bring them right up to the very edge in terms of having a sign-up flow, the editor, showing them everything that is behind the promise lines, while at the conclusion of which, when you're trying to build out an experience, is when we sort of let them know that, hey, here's a product that's work in progress, and we truly believe you could be a really incredible early adopter. I'd love to chat with you and set you up on 6 months free on the product when it does launch, right? And that sort of really worked well for us, where we were able to dramatically launch in terms of having a 3-week timeline, if I'm not wrong, to get from zero to launch, including setting up the entire product up, the supposed product up and its landing pages, etc. And then build out a consumer list of more than 25,000 users within the first couple of months of when it was out there. And given that it was in a niche space like virtual and augmented reality, every step is an expensive one and every misstep is an even more expensive one. So the more time you spend validating whether your user cares about this or just gives a damn is a lot better as compared to building it in just haste or building it because you know how to code and then looking back and realizing, God damn it, I just wish I had spent more time trying to understand if what I'm building is useful in the first place.
Totally agree with that. I really like that story too, especially where like your product is super niche. Like I think most people would be like, cool, I'll build this because it's super niche. I know there's like a problem in that market and then we'll just see how many people come. But yeah, just running like a simple campaign with a landing page like makes total sense. So tell us about like your first customer. What was that experience like? Was it somebody that did you just email all the 25,000 people? Did you just do like a segmented test? What did your first customer look like and what was the experience that you had with that first customer? And were they a paying customer?
Interestingly, they were a paying customer. We sort of put our foot down early on where we said, if you really want to validate whether a product's useful or not, make them open their wallets up. Everyone's going to say good things about you in your surveys unless you ask them for a dollar. So our first customer was a fairly large mobile phone manufacturer, like a smartphone manufacturer who wanted to promote their devices using augmented reality, 3D, AR, so on and so forth. The interesting part was, how do you fit into a marketing campaign when there is just no budgets for it in the first place, right? Like nobody wakes up on a daily basis and just realizes, oh, let me spend $100,000 in augmented reality today, right? So you're sort of going into a room, you're a teacher first up, then you're a salesperson, and then you're a bargainer or a negotiator in terms of trying to ensure that your platform is paid for. So I think the first experience of selling to a customer was brutal. Because technologies in the deep tech space are an afterthought, and technologies in the deep tech space that a small startup is building, which is trying to monetize off you, seems ludicrous to begin with, right? So how do you now change that notion around and actually show them enough value on the table before there is a launch or before there is historical data they can rely on, saying my competitors did this, so I need to do it as well. I think that was really tricky. We're in a far better space now because of how far these technologies have come and the whole conversation around the metaverse and like crypto sort of fueling to this, so on and so forth. But back then it was a lonely, harsh battle. And so the first three customers were built on grit, spit, and duct tape. I think that's mostly what got us over the line.
And you also said something really interesting right before this, is you talked about customers, about saying, hey, early on, let's put you on for a few weeks or a few months at a time, right? And let's see how it works. And at that point, then we can talk about actual prices and things like that. And I think some people just kind of overlook that, be like, hey, like, get them in there, let them see how good it is, and then it's going to be easier to open their wallet because they see the value in it, right? Because the product will kind of sell itself. I kind of want to go back a little bit about your decision to go no code. The big reason why you went no code was because there's a pattern, right? Like back in the day, you had to code your website, right? And it was really difficult. And then, you know, Weebly and Webflow and all these no code tools came out. And so people who don't have that ability can go in and build a website, right? And you just saw that type of pattern, but in augmented reality?
I think we see that pattern across software in general, right? Workflows that are incredibly code dependent eventually normalize out to a platform that's trying to solve or abstract the coding layer out and provide you a visual layer in order to achieve the end state. Now, this could be on setting up a blog back in the days, from Blogspot to what was like before that, to setting up websites, to custom Salesforce integrations. I think we've seen it in multiple pockets on the internet, where as a TAM grows larger, and if this is increasingly dependent on a code-based workflow, companies find a way in order to abstract the code layer out and thereby democratize this out to a larger part of the funnel, or a part of the funnel that's above what it might be right now. So we saw that thematically, the race in order to go no-code for large served markets, which are deeply code-enabled, was something that is not going to die out, or was not a fad, but rather a consistent pattern that we were observing across the industry at large. And we saw no reason why it would be any different with AR or VR. And we in fact thought it's going to be a lot more painful in industries like these in order for you to take a code-first approach. There is a lot of value to take code-first approaches for like deeply specific projects, but for the 80%, right, which is a large part of where the typical market tends to operate at, how do you now build a tool that's simple enough, intuitive enough, as well as aligned with respect to your success, where it's you get started free of cost, and then you eventually start paying only when you have upside? That flips the entire narrative over from saying you've got to build a team of, say, 10 developers and cough up a significant amount of money even before you have a project out there.
I just don't think our listeners understand. So this is something Austin taught me. The easier something is to use, the harder it was to build at the beginning. Right? Like, and I feel like that's that no cool tool of like, and there's a reason why there wasn't anybody in that space, because you said it yourself, what it's going to take to build an augmented or virtual reality no code platform was going to take a lot of code, right? And a lot of resource and a lot of sticker price. And I'm just curious on your thought process, how did you overcome that?
One way to do that is to make your customers pay for it. What do I mean by that is, build an open roadmap, be as transparent as you can with your users, which we were. We said, hey, look, a bunch of these features are not built out yet. But if you think this is important, I'm going to have a completely open roadmap, and I'm going to allow you to not just vote, but vociferously comment on why you would want this feature to be built in. Now, the moment I promise this feature out for you, I'm going to upgrade you, or I'm going to move you from a one tier of payment to a much higher price tier, which is in the promise that if this feature goes live, I would see you as a customer moving or upgrading yourself to a premium user, or not just a premium user, but say someone who's paying me a lot in the premium segment. So it was sort of a bi-directional thing where customers felt like they were being heard. And at the same point of time, we ensured that every hour of work that was spent was on something that people were clamoring for at some point of time before we decided to set foot into building one. For example, we wanted to build a Shopify integration for like the e-commerce workflows that were in place. We had close to about 50 businesses at some point saying, I would cough up a certain amount of money if you launch it tomorrow. And we sort of built a waterfalling cascade there, where we said, if I'm launching this tomorrow, I'm going to automatically upgrade you to this tier. Are you okay with it? And the customer said, that's perfectly fine. And which means that I'm retroactively making my customers pay for the features that they want, and thereby also funding the work that goes behind building a feature like that in the first place.
You're pre-selling all of your features. That's what you're doing. You're getting pre-sales for every single feature and be like, oh, you really want that? Would you pay for it? Yes. So when I have it, you'll pay for it. Yes. Great. Let's start building it. What better validation?
The part is you have their credit card built in as well, right? So they're already in somewhere sort of caught in. So that just helps us move faster.
Yeah. So it's like, as soon as it launches, you have a list of 15, 30 clients or whatever it is that all of a sudden increase their monthly bill or their service that they're paying for. That is the best way to validate an idea is, and you said it, you're letting the customers feel like they're being heard because you're releasing features that they want, but at the same time, you're monetizing those features because upfront at the beginning, before it's even done, you're saying, hey, if the app does X, Y, or Z, will you pay this much? Yes. Great. Go ahead and sign this. I already have your credit card on file. And then when that launches, then you guys already have those pre-sales. That's awesome.
And it's also a way to prevent our own biases from taking over, which is if you ask a developer, what should the next feature of the product be? A developer is going to 10 out of 10 times tell you more features, right? Or more complex features, or let's make this part of the tool for a power user. While your normal users are going to tell you, just make it simpler. So I think it's a very elegant way to not let feature creep be built into a tool or a platform in the early days, where very rarely is your answer from $0 to $1 million in ARR about throwing more features in as compared to throwing more useful features. And making that differentiation, ideally, if it's your customer doing that for you, nothing like it. Do not question that. Just go ahead and build it out so that you're able to cater to an audience that truly cares about what you're doing outside your own conference room.
You are speaking my language right now, because that is like the biggest thing that I try and convince people, like very early, is that they need to really simplify their product and to make users ask. And I always say to do that, not because it ultimately like makes the product easier to build and so it's easier for me, but it also lets the customers to do two things. One, they get to tell you what they want you to build. And two, you actually get to build that for them. And so you start to build that brand trust very, very early. So I think you really accomplish those two things by taking that approach. But I think as both a technical founder and a non-technical founder, really refining your product roadmap is something that's not necessarily easy to do, right? So I want you to kind of explain to us like your initial process when you were building this. How did you take a problem that was really complex? And in the AR world, there's a lot of complex things that you have to consider. How did you take that and really make it simple? And I know this is more of like a product question, but I'm curious to see your response, and I think it would bring a ton of value.
Saying no is hard, no matter how many times we sort of put it out there. I think when you really are at it and you're passionately building something from day one, saying no to 9 out of 10 features is not just hard, but it breaks your heart, right? If this is for the first time you're trying something. But I think it's important. The reason I say that is each time you do that, you're working on a boundary condition, a constraint. And constraints are where you think that your products can be not just useful, but brutally useful. So what we used to say was, how do we get something done in nothing more than 3 screens, right? If all of us in the team had 3 screens or 3 states in order to build out, and that's it, right? Like a game of Monopoly, you have exhausted all your money at the end of it. What are you going to build out? How are you going to get there, right? So we created artificial scarcity on the end state, saying this is all the time and the money that we have in order to build this out. Now we either build it here or we just shut our laptops down, right? So by creating a sense of that scarcity, what you're able to do is immediately realize that your plate's not big enough, right? And if the plate's not big enough, no matter what, there is only so much you can do. If you're respectful to the boundary lines of scarcity that you're able to build, the constraint is set. And when constraints are set, you don't have a choice but to say no to the frivolous features. So find a way to create a guardrail for yourself. The guardrail can be through time, money, or just discipline. And if you're able to create these guardrails in place and then bring your users inside the fence, your users are going to tell you, hey, look, if this is the first version of the product, I definitely need A, B, and C. Well, just build A, B, and C, right? Or just build A, and then take the users on your ride to build B and C together. Right? You're never too early to launch, and you're never too early to involve your users in that journey. So the way we tried to do that was just generate artificial constraint, slug it out in the office, and just ensure that thoughtful decision-making goes behind building a feature, or build half a feature and just put it out there, and eventually just bring the users along in the journey with you.
I love that, mainly because like I've recently had a couple conversations where people have been like, hey, you know, I've got X amount of budget and I need to complete X, Y, Z things within this budget. I'm sure in your experience, you noticed that that's probably not the best way to do that. And I know what I'm convincing people is that, no, you're actually looking at this wrong. It's going to be better to have something more simple. Like, it's just not possible to build all of those things within that budget. So as you're refining it, like, what did you tell yourself? Was it just strictly the discipline that you had? Was it just the understanding of how, you know, building a company works? How did you change your mindset from, hey, I've got X amount, I need to complete all of these things in X amount, and instead really teach yourself that it's okay to only get so far with X amount and we'll come up with a way to get farther when the time comes, or start prepping for it now?
I came across a fairly well-done infographic on the internet which said, if you're going from point A to point B and you have only a certain amount of money to do it, don't build something with just four wheels, right? Like, don't try to build a car with nothing, just with just four wheels. Rather just build a bicycle and get there, right? So with your money, it's not needed to build one third a car. It's important to build a really good bicycle, right? So the first version of your product needs to be great, right? Make no mistake. But it needs to be great in a very, very, very specific sort of objective. And that's not five features. That's probably just one feature done really well, which is going to be very provocative for the user to stick around, to bother enough about the second feature that's coming up, right? So if the budget's built towards getting one or two or just a certain number of these features which your customers absolutely can't live without, and just nailing those, I think that's money and time better spent in building a more successful company as compared to trying to do a half-assed job of 10 odd features. While you think you might have a feature-rich product, you're just going to have a middling product out there which I, as an average user, might not feel compelled to use for the second time.
I totally agree with that. I think people just don't understand the beauty and simplicity. Like, people are coming to you typically because the problem that they have is so small and no other product solves that specific problem well. And so if you really niche down and solve one problem really well, not five, but one problem really well, you're typically going to build a better relationship with people using your product.
Right. Well, and those relationships mean that your users are going to stick around for you to go solve from problem one to problem five, which is always better than trying to build or solve five problems and not having anybody stick around.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting the way you put it. Because, like, in reality, our clients come to us and the real problem is getting from point A to point B. But they think the problem is, I don't have a car, right? And so they think this mindset of, like, I have to build a car, I have to build a car. The problem is getting from point A to point B. It's not that you don't have a car. So instead of building something with four wheels and a car and it's expensive to build, you said it great, build a bike, because you'll still solve the problem of getting from point A to point B. That's the real problem, not that you don't have a car, right? And build a really, really good bike. And then as you continue to get back and forth between point A to point B, you can improve on that bike and make it a tricycle, make it bigger and a better and a car with a motor and an engine. And, like, but I think our clients sometimes forget what the true problem is. And if you can solve that problem in the most simple possible way, I think that's where you're going to be successful, right? It doesn't have to be the most expensive option, but it's still solving that problem. And then to add on it, you said, bring customers along with you, right? Let them kind of guide the way of the direction that you should go, right?
Completely. I think SaaS products today are increasingly dependent, driven, and decision made around great formed communities. And these communities inevitably reduce the cost to development because they save you thousands of hours of time deliberating on what's the right thing to be built, because they're just sitting out there upvoting on exactly what you need to be building out in the first place. So it goes from guesstimation to not even guesswork at this point of time. It is very specific, very directional, and also very opinionated, because great software also has very, very, very vociferous crowds sort of being built around them. And we've always seen this. We've seen a lot of serendipity around how software has formed people around them, which is, we've got PowerPoint and just like entire microcosms of communities being built around it without any directional effort from Microsoft on that. But now the next wave of software that's out there is going to be built keeping in mind that you want to build these pockets of people to be very vociferous about how they're saying the right things, or at least helping you improve on what you need to do. So given that these communities are going to become important, how do you not just foster them, but how do you make meaningful relationships outside, like a Discord server? Right, I think those sort of are going to be the areas that really make it easy for startups to scale out from an idea to launch to having a thriving community of users around it.
Yeah. So, did you have to raise any funding as you're building this?
Right. So we did a seed round, which was around 2018. And since then, we were sort of building the org out. We scaled up to over a couple of million ARR, and we were about to stitch together our next round as well. And the team was about 40 members strong. And it was around that time that through the pandemic, e-commerce sort of really took off. And what was supposed to be another round of capital inevitably turned out into an acquisition by the Walmart-owned company called Flipkart, where I think the inevitable part was, hey, look, this is an important part of how e-commerce would evolve out. People will increasingly buy through the camera. And given that the camera now needs to differentiate itself in meaningful ways, augmented reality happens to be the inevitable answer there. So since then, I think we've been busy building out like an AR platform that serves for specifically e-commerce and the 150 million odd users that reside on top of Flipkart's platform right now.
Well, that's awesome. That's super cool to hear. When you were raising that seed round, what would you say was the most important thing that you did to help raise that round? Outside of, you know, having a solid product and having like revenue and like users, like what would you say like fundamentally that you did really well when it came to raising a round?
Right. So interestingly, we had none of those when we did close the round. We were pre-product, pre-revenue, and probably pre-pitch deck. So one of the things that really helped us through there was...
Sai, you were literally a napkin with an idea still. Is that kind of what...
pretty much. That was exactly the stage that we were at. And one of the most important lessons which I learned through that was great teams, if they meet bad markets, the market still wins. You're going to get crushed. Right. If you're a bad team, you meet a great market, you're still going to do okay. The market wins. If great teams meet great markets, that's when you build truly meaningful companies. Right. So no matter what, as much as we like to believe that we're in control, honestly, the market's in control. Right. So go after the biggest, largest, most thorny problem that you're able to think about, because the effort it takes to build a small org, a mid-sized org, or a very large, ambitious idea is pretty much the same. It's just as painful. You're going to give it your 100% no matter what. You might as well go after the largest problem that you think is useful in the world to exist and be solved for. So we went after a pretty large market, and the TAM sort of kept increasing through. And we always were of the belief that if this market's going to play itself out, our space in the play is going to inevitably be of a meaningful one. So always been a big believer that great markets inevitably make great entrepreneurs and great companies.
I love that. The exact phrase of a great team meets a bad market, the market will win. A bad team meets a good market, they can still win. But the really successful is a great team meets a great market and makes great entrepreneurs, which actually transitions to my next question. I'm really curious, what makes a great team? How did you find a great team? And what were you looking for? As our founders are very early on, they're by themselves, they have a great market. How do you find a great team?
An easy answer for that is to find your way into a bad team so you truly know what not to do. But outside
that sounds like an expensive way of learning it.
I think outside that, you optimize not for the same vectors, but opposite vectors. Like, I think the one thing that early stage entrepreneurs tend to do is he or she thinks like me. He or she shares the same skill sets. Oh, so they must be a great co-founder. And now that's the most common mistake that I might have seen through my journey as well. Instead, I think if you were to look at vectors that point in different directions, but help the org move faster, I think that makes for a great complementary team, right? Skill sets that are not necessarily overlapping entirely, but just has enough in between them in order for the two of you to spend 10 hours in the same room and come out of it feeling energized as compared to trained. So I think if I were to break it down into a framework, the first part of the framework is just, how do you get along with the other person, right? Like, we tend to put up with a significant amount of discomfort before we realize something's not right in the bridge. The second is, what parts of the company do I take ownership on versus what my co-founder could take ownership on? And if these are not instantly coming to the top of your mind, recalibrate, right? Like, it can't be engineered, right? Like, they either come with the skill set or you sort of don't have that skill set, right? So it needs to be very upfront as to where roles, responsibilities, and key areas can sort of come together. And the last part of this is, what is the ability for them to attract your next set of team members, right? Are you going to feel inspired working with them? And your next five employees are going to feel inspired working with them. Because as much as a co-founder is important, if the org does not scale beyond the co-founder to the next 5 to 10 people, you're still stuck in a problem. Right. So the ability for you, your founding team, in order to attract talent as well as feel inspired between each other is just as important as it is in order to see whether your vectors are sort of pointing in the right directions and are able to cover for most of the areas of what goes behind building a company in the first place.
Sai, you have such good advice on this.
Well, I took the more expensive route from time to time. So I think inevitably I found what not to do before I optimized for what to do.
Do you want to go through a whole section of what not to do? Because that's the expensive route, right? That's learning that hard path. And like I said, you said it really great. You said, how do you build a good team? Go get on a bad team first, right? Go see what a bad team looks like and then go from there. I think that's not bad advice. It's just learn from a bad team, right? Like that's really what it comes down to.
And I think very often we select bad teams because we are in desperation to just find it. A lot of poor team decision making stems from, I have an idea. I want to get started with it as much as possible. I'm probably bored with what I do right now. Let me just hop on the first boat that comes across my way and then sort of ride it out. Now, very few times do we remember that if this turns out well, it's a 7 to 10 year journey with the other person. I think we don't spend enough time trying to understand that in case of a good outcome, which is what you want it to be, this is going to take 10 years, right? And the moment you sort of put that mirror in front of entrepreneurs, they would immediately pause and think again, saying, oh, am I going to devote 10 years to this? Am I going to devote 10 years to this person? That then changes the narrative. So I think if there was a playbook around what you can do to consider these relationships as they are built out, it would be a lot more useful, which is why you see the biggest VCs out there as well fund teams who have a significant amount of history tracing back, right? You're unlikely to build confidence with your customers, your investors, or with the rest of your team if the two of you just met at a tech conference just day before yesterday. You're a lot more likely to build something meaningful if you're going to trace back over a period of time. You understand the other person's strengths, weaknesses. You're able to compensate for the fact that each one of you guys might have a sinusoidal point of time in the org where someone has to step up while the other person probably takes a breather and vice versa. So when you sort of have those dynamics in place, which are built over months, if not years, I think that's a great recipe for you to start considering whether that is where you begin to build a company around.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Well, Sai, like I want to thank you for coming on to our show. Like we had a lot of fun. Where can everybody like find you, reach out to you and learn more about Skapik?
Right. So Skapik right now is integrated right into Flipkart. So if anybody is shopping on Flipkart as an application, which is India's largest or / most used e-commerce destination, that's on the Flipkart app. So you would find it right there. Outside that, you could just log on to skapik.com where some of the SaaS products are still up and running for like some of the world's largest e-commerce enterprises. Outside this, I would be on SciTech, which is sort of the handles that I happen to be on right at the moment. So you would find me rabbit holing across the world of 3D, the metaverse, NFTs, and AR. And again, I might not know everything on what to do, but what not to do, I think you might have some answers.
You got a good say there. That's awesome. Sai, thank you so much for joining us.